Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bruce Shapiro, a contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who assesses the war on terrorism here at home and the consequences for civil liberties and the Bill of Rights. Rabbi Arthur Waskow, director of Philadelphia's Shalom Center, who examines the connection between the Israeli government policy of assassinating Palestinian militants and the growing number of suicide bombings organized by extremist groups. And Sarah Anderson, with the Institute for Policy Studies, who evaluates the factors which led to the passage of the fast-track trade bill in the House of Representatives, legislation opposed by many labor, environmental, and human rights groups. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In recent days, Argentina has come close to the edge of major financial ruin. The current crisis came to a head in early December when the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, refused to provide a $1.3 billion loan to prevent Argentina from defaulting on its huge $132 billion debt. To stop Argentina's currency from collapsing, the IMF is putting severe restrictions on issuing new credit, including the possible imposition of a 10% cut in the national budget. Such demands will not be popular in the South American country, burdened with a staggering 17% unemployment rate and continuing recession. According to The Nation magazine, Argentina is suffering the effects of an IMF policy which pegs its currency to the U.S. dollar. The same thing happened in 1998 in both Brazil and Russia, when both nations eventually defaulted on their debt. For months, Argentina has followed the IMF structural adjustment policy by cutting state pensions, unemployment benefits, and other social programs. In the end, the IMF is not as concerned about Argentina and its masses of poor people as it is about U.S. bankers and other emerging market investors who have lent money there. If Argentina defaults, these investors would scream for a bailout, so the IMF continues to pressure Argentina for more social cuts. The economies of Latin America have stagnated under the IMF structural adjustment programs begun in the 1980s. Over the last 20 years, Latin American economies have only grown an anemic 6% versus a rapid 75% growth rate in the 1960s and 70s. Over the long haul, the IMF, according to The Nation magazine, has just not been very good for investors or consumers in the developing world. 2 years ago, German pacifists were outraged when the German Green Party voted to send troops to support the NATO campaign in Kosovo. The Greens are now part of the coalition government of Chancellor Gerhard Schröder of the Social Democratic Party. In mid-November, the Green Party for a second time voted to send German troops abroad, this time to be part of the U.S.-led assault on Afghanistan. It will be the first time since World War II that German troops have been stationed in a war zone. But now there is little outcry expected from green pacifists. According to Mother Jones magazine, many left-wing activists and loyal Greens have given up on the party. Lise Velker quit the Green Party over the decision to support military force in Kosovo. She complained, quote, "They have become power politicians. You need to know the boundaries, and I think the Greens have stepped over the line." German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer, leader of the Green Party's ruling realist faction, says the party, as part of the government, has won a phase-out of nuclear power plants, adoption of civil unions for gay and lesbian couples, and pending reforms of German immigration policy. Yet the Greens have lost voters at the polls. Over the last 3 years, the Green Party has lost 17 seats in regional elections, and 10% of party members have quit. The party may move further into the mainstream at the next Green Party Congress in March if it decides to scrap their platform to oppose all foreign military intervention. But the real crunch may come during the 2002 German national election. Many observers now wonder if the Greens can muster 5% of the vote, the minimum it needs to remain a viable political party. The London-based Guardian newspaper reports that anti-globalization protesters could be the next target of the international war on terrorism. In early December, the European Union Council of Ministers debated a proposal to ban the travel of so-called violent protesters across Europe after intense clashes this summer between global justice activists and police in Gothenburg, Sweden, and Genoa, Italy. The proposed ban, put forth by Belgium, would place the names of protesters accused of participating in public disorder into a European-wide database, along with the identities of illegal immigrants and rejected asylum seekers. EU members Finland and Sweden, along with Norway, have publicly opposed the plan to clamp down on political dissent. Tony Bunyan of Statewatch, a European civil liberties group, warned, "We now have the frightening prospect that the details of suspected terrorists and dissidents will be held on a centralized European database to be the subject of targeted action and surveillance." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Since September 11th, the Bush administration, with Attorney General John Ashcroft as their point man, has undertaken a program to conduct a war on terrorism here at home. With new powers authorized by Congress and executive orders, the government now has the ability to secretly detain immigrants indefinitely without charge, wiretap phone and electronic communication, convene military tribunals, and eavesdrop on conversations between some attorneys and their clients. The White House has also discussed a plan to lift restrictions on FBI surveillance of U.S. political and religious groups. Before a Senate Judiciary Committee on December 6th, Attorney General Ashcroft dismissed civil libertarians who have been critical of the administration's anti-terrorism agenda. He told the legislators that what the nation needs is honest, reasoned debate, not fear-mongering. But Mr. Ashcroft angered many when, in so many words, he labeled those raising questions about his policies as aiding America's enemies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Shapiro, a contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who takes a critical look at the domestic front of the war on terrorism and the consequences for civil liberties and the Bill of Rights.
Well, like a lot of people, I'm appalled by obvious intrusion on human rights and civil rights, and in this, I hold no monopoly on this, no less than Mary Robinson, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, yesterday said that she was very alarmed by the presidential order permitting military tribunals and some other aspects of the war on terrorism. But I think what a lot of people are missing in the discussion of this is that not only are there obvious infringements on the right to counsel, and not only do we have infringements on the right to due process of law with secret evidence and things, but all of these measures are actually impeding the investigation and are actually impeding public safety. What do I mean? Impeding the resolution of the Al-Qaeda problem. What do I mean? Well, let's take for a minute this question of military tribunals for non-citizens. The White House has been backpedaling like crazy like this, insisting, as John Ashcroft did during his hearings, that it would be used only for war criminals and probably only people arrested abroad. But that's not the language of the order. The order, in fact, would allow military tribunals for all non-citizens in the United States or abroad. It's not just a battlefield drumhead court. But what's interesting about this is that this is causing tremendous consternation among our European allies. The Blair administration is tied in knots over military tribunals and the death penalty over in Britain. At first, they said over the weekend they couldn't even imagine extraditing Osama bin Laden himself. Should any of their troops arrest him? In Spain, Spanish prosecutor Baltasar Garzon, who's the man who prosecuted General Pinochet and now has indicted and arrested 8 Al-Qaeda suspects over there, has said in no uncertain terms that Spain, as a party to the European Union's human rights conventions, could not hand those suspects over to the United States if they are to face military tribunals. So we're, on that level, disrupting our relationship with our allies. And at home, you've got police chiefs all over the country, including the police chief of, Portland, Oregon, for example, who are saying that they are unable by law and unwilling as a matter of legal practice to participate in these open-ended trawls among Middle Eastern immigrants. The racial profiling that we were promised would not occur. What all of these law enforcement officials know is that in order to succeed in rooting out the Al-Qaeda mafia, they need the cooperation. They need they need trusting relationships with immigrant communities. Attorney General Ashcroft's tack here is disrupting those trusting relationships. The FBI agents themselves are not happy about this. It's actually impeding the investigation and impeding the speedy legal resolution of the Al-Qaeda problem.
Last week, one of the most controversial things said by Attorney General Ashcroft was the following in front of the Senate hearings. He said, "We need honest, reasoned debate and not fear-mongering. To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this. Your tactics only aid terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends." In essence, he's saying, if you're a critic, you could be a traitor. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, you know, I've been called subversive by better men than John Ashcroft. But the language that Ashcroft is using alarms me very much. This is the language of J. Edgar Hoover. This is the language of witch hunts. This is the language of demonizing any critics of the administration's policy, calling us one step short of traitors. And traitors, of course, are people who ought to be taken out back and shot. You know, this is nothing but an intimidation tactic. And what's more, it says to me that this Justice Department is blowing a lot of smoke trying to distract attention from the fact that their investigation into Al-Qaeda is not going anywhere. And by calling up the specter of subversion at home and calling us, allies of the terrorists, they're really just trying to cover up that fact. It is very alarming to hear the highest law enforcement official in the United States really trying to intimidate critics of his policies with that kind of language. It's something that we really left behind in the McCarthy era, and it's alarming to see it resurrected again.
That was Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine. Read Shapiro's articles on civil liberties issues at www.thenation.com. Weeks of escalating violence in the Middle East claimed the lives of two young boys ages 2 and 13 years old on December 10th after Israeli helicopters fired missiles at a car carrying a man they accused of planning terrorist attacks. The target of the assassination, Mohammed Sadir, who Israelis say was a local leader of the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad, was wounded in the assault along with his uncle and five others. Israel has stepped up its attacks on Yasser Arafat's governing authority and individuals it suspects of engaging in terrorism after three suicide bomb attacks killed 26 Israeli civilians on December 1st and 2nd. Contributing to the cycle of violence was the November 23rd Israeli assassination of a leader of the militant group Hamas and the deaths of five Palestinian boys killed by a bomb planted by the Israeli army on November 22nd. Despite Arafat's arrest of more than 150 Palestinians thought to be connected with terror attacks, Israeli and U.S. officials demanded that he do more to dismantle Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rabbi Arthur Waskow, director of Philadelphia's Shalom Center, who examines the connection between the Israeli government's policy of assassination and what many believe to be the predictable intensification of violence now stretching into 14 months of conflict.
I've just been reading an article that was published in a quite conservative Israeli newspaper, the mass circulation daily Yediot Ahronot, which is not a left or even left of center paper, it's right of center. Its major military and security expert, who has spent years and years and years close to and listening to and working with members of high officials in the army and the intelligence operations, did just a couple of weekends ago a front-page article. They gave it major special prominence, which said that the, whatever you want to call it, liquidation, assassination, targeted killing of a Hamas leader by the Sharon government, everybody knew, I mean, the people who did it knew, would become the trigger for the suicide bombings in Jerusalem and in Haifa. and that the Israeli government knew perfectly well that's what it was going to trigger. He writes, in fact, whoever gave a green light to this act of liquidation, and we know it had to be Sharon, knew full well he is thereby shattering in one blow, now listen to this, the gentleman's agreement between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Under that agreement, Hamas was to avoid suicide bombings inside the Green Line. So Hamas, in fact, had made a deal, and the Israelis knew they had made a deal, with Arafat and the Palestinian Authority to stop such bombings. Then came the attack, the killing of a Hamas leader, and of course the deal was off. And the Israeli government knew that perfectly well. In fact, one would have to either think that Sharon is abysmally stupid or that he is deliberately choosing a series of actions which then inspire disgusting actions by ultra-nationalist Palestinians, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So it's like a conspiracy of warnicks, you might say, a conspiracy of right-wingers, both Palestinian and Israeli, who act in such ways as to make it impossible to get peace. Now, why are they doing that? I mean, are they just abysmally stupid? I think they're abysmally stupid in the long run. They think that they are going to win something out of this. Each one thinks. Sharon thinks that if there can be provoked more and more and more violence, that Israel will win full control over the West Bank, that the Palestinians will end up in a kind of civil war between themselves and end up totally exhausted, demoralized, many of them leaving, the leadership probably leaving, many of them killed by each other or by Israeli action, and that Israel can establish what Sharon has wanted for 30 years to establish, full control over the West Bank. Now, what does Hamas think it's going to get out of stirring more and more war and preventing a peace settlement? Hamas, in the long run, wants the mirror image of what Sharon wants. Hamas, in the long run, wants the shattering of the state of Israel. And they think, in the long run, if this can be kept up, then inside Israel, the Palestinian minority, that is the Israeli citizens of Palestinian origin, will become more and more radicalized and alienated from the state of Israel, and that Muslims and Arabs elsewhere will finally rise up. Now, I think both those predictions are crazy. The result is much more likely to be an incredible bloodbath, including very possibly sometime down the line a nuclear bloodbath in the Middle East. But I think each of those right-wing groups thinks it can win what it still fantasizes as total victory, the shattering of the Palestinian people, the shattering of Israel, still thinks they can win that if they prevent a peace settlement.
Rabbi Wasko, when it comes to Ariel Sharon and his government, do you think he, as the head of state of Israel, is capable of making a peace with the Palestinians?
His whole life history suggests not. His whole life history suggests that he has taken every opportunity he has had to attack, to roll back, to suppress the possibility of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, at peace with Israel on the West Bank. From the days when he would say the Palestinians should all move to Jordan and they should overthrow King Hussein and that should be the Palestinian state, but leave Israel for the West Bank. When he led the invasion of Lebanon, it was because there were, this was 1980, because there were the first major signs of a kind of nonviolent version of the Intifada, of what later became the Intifada, was beginning to happen on the West Bank and Gaza, and he wanted to shatter the infrastructure of Palestinian nationalism, which he thought he could do by attacking the PLO's strongholds in southern Lebanon. And that was the basic reason for the invasion of Lebanon, that he was trying to do in the Palestinian structure before it could become, even nonviolently, become an effective resistance. He has never, I mean, it's not just Lebanon, not just Sabra and Shatila, but before that, his whole history. I do not think there is any reason to expect that he would move in a decent direction.
That was Rabbi Arthur Waskow, director of Philadelphia's Shalom Center. Contact the Shalom Center by calling area code 215-844-8494 or visit their website at www.shalomctr.org. In a cliffhanger of a vote on December 6th, the House of Representatives approved by a one-vote margin, 215 to 214, the Trade Promotion Authority bill opposed by many labor, environmental, and human rights activists. The legislation, formerly known as Fast Track, will grant the president authority to negotiate future international trade deals with minimal debate in Congress and no chance for legislators to propose corrective amendments. The White House, Republican leaders, and their corporate allies spent millions of dollars to win passage of Fast Track, even claiming that a vote for the bill was a patriotic duty while the nation wages war against terrorism. The legislation next moves to the U.S. Senate, where most observers predict an easy victory for the president. If signed into law, Fast Track will enable the White House to expedite approval of the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, or FTAA, which, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been criticized for the lack of labor or environmental standards and the power it surrenders to corporations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project, who assesses the factors which led to Fast Track's passage and the fight ahead for activists opposing economic policies that advance corporate-led globalization.
It's about a procedural issue, but this debate really became much bigger. It became a referendum on the U.S. government's trade policy in general. So it became a referendum on the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has been in effect for the past 7 years. It became a referendum on the World Trade Organization. And because the majority of Americans are very skeptical about these deals, don't think they've been working out, there was very stiff opposition. But on the other side, of course, we had the whole Fortune 500, corporate America united in support of it, and they really did help ram it through. And the reasons why the Bush administration wanted this thing so badly is because they're eager to accelerate negotiations around an idea to expand NAFTA to the whole Western Hemisphere, so to have a free trade agreement that would include 34 countries throughout the Americas, and then also to really step up action underneath the, well, within the World Trade Organization. They had a meeting people might have heard about in early November where they launched a new round of negotiations. And the Bush administration argues that other countries don't really want to sit down and negotiate with the U.S. unless they have this fast track. So they eked out a one-vote majority win, and now they're going to use that to claim that they have a mandate in support of their trade agenda.
What are the forces who oppose free trade and free trade treaties of the future? What are they going to do to counter the Bush administration and their allies in corporate America for what they will do next, which is, of course, to get the Free Trade Area of the Americas treaty passed?
Yeah, well, it is good to remind folks that, you know, just because they pass the fast track by this one vote, it certainly doesn't mean that they're going to have an easy time with this deal. And so I think what a lot of people are feeling is that we need to link up more with people in other countries in the hemisphere who are also very concerned about this deal. We have a lot of allies and trade unions and environmental groups and others around the hemisphere. In fact, there's a network that's formed called the Hemispheric Social Alliance that links up the major labor federations, including the AFL-CIO here in the United States, but, you know, major and influential trade unions in Brazil and elsewhere, along with citizens' networks, these, you know, amazing multi-sectoral, wildly diverse coalitions that have come together in opposition to free trade in the United States and in many other countries in the hemisphere. And we're going to try to work together and see if we can fight this thing.
Sarah, from every analysis I've read, it's a sure bet that the Senate, marginally controlled by the Democrats, is going to pass this fast track or trade promotion authority. Is that right?
Well, that's what people are expecting. The Senate has always been more gung-ho about free trade than the House has been, although it could get interesting because the Democratic leader in the Senate, Daschle, is actually opposed to it personally. And so this is certainly not going to be his big crusade to get this thing passed. And he has indicated that he doesn't want to bring it up for a vote until after the holidays. He's going to push it into the new year, which the Republicans are not very happy about. So perhaps there could be something interesting that happens in the Senate, but what most people expect is that it'll be hard to muster even about 40 senators against it.
Sarah, I wondered if you would comment on the state of the worldwide movement opposing corporate-led globalization. There's a lot of momentum coming out of the Seattle demonstrations here in this country 2 years ago. But since that time, even before September 11th, the movement's been subjected to increasing police repression and surveillance and intimidation. What's your read on where the movement is now?
I tell you, this is a really tough time for this movement. People are struggling. You know, I worked very hard to help with the mobilization around the World Bank and the IMF meetings that were supposed to happen here in Washington at the end of September. And we were on a real high because we felt like we were being taken very seriously by the mainstream media. We felt like we were being listened to. And then, of course, everything came crashing down, and we are in this totally new environment right now. I think that, you know, we need to think creatively about changing our tactics. I think that probably the very confrontational kinds of strategies just aren't going to work in this new atmosphere. We need to find ways to get attention, but get them in a different way, and also really be clear about what our agenda is. And one thing I'm looking forward to is the end of January, I'll be going to Brazil for the World Social Forum, which is something that first started last year, which will draw tens of thousands of people from around the world who are working on these issues. And it'll be a space to really think through our own agenda, not be in confrontation with any of the bad guys. The bad guys won't be anywhere around there. And I think it'll be a really important meeting for people to sort of sort out where we are and how we pick up the momentum that we had before 9/11.
That was Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project. Contact IPS by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.